Morning. Welcome to episode 30 of the Driller Newscast, a weekly update on the news and stories impacting the water well and industrial drilling industry. Episode 30 is brought to you by Wildbend Incorporated. Wildbend Inc., a privately held, family-owned business, has been providing high-quality drilling fluid products since 1951. Wildbend's knowledgeable customer service, sales, and research people bring industry-leading products and support to the marketplace. The innovative products are the result of field-driven solutions and dedication to the customer's goals. This week in the news, we'll talk about the Department of Interior's group, Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement, which has new proposed rules to ensure offshore oil and gas operations on the outer continental shelf, that's the Gulf, are conducted with the utmost safety and oversight standards. Our main story of the week is on the EPA's use of the utilization of the Clean Water Act provision called residual designation authority, under which the agency will require permit coverage for stormwater discharge from currently unregulated, uncontrolled sources of stormwater pollution. But before we get into this week's news, let's talk about job site preparedness. For this week's safety topic, I want to know what your triage preparedness is. I want you to think about our projects that we're on and the tools we invest in, the bits, the drilling fluid technology, all the training and professional development. Are we first aid trained? Do we have the right tools if that catastrophic event happens? Did you know OSHA regulations state that for workplaces where serious accidents, such as those involving falls, suffocation, electrocution, or amputation are possible, emergency medical services should be 3 to 4 minutes away? Otherwise, an individual on site must be trained in first aid and CPR. I want you to think about your past 10 jobs. How many of them had EMS less than 4 minutes away? These serious accidents that we just talked about, falls, electrocution, suffocation, caught in between, they're common on every one of our drilling and pump sites. Our drill teams must be appropriately trained to administer care when a member is injured on site. Immediate response to a serious injury can avoid permanent damage or death. When prevention fails from our safety program and a team member is injured, their well-being depends on our swift action of the team. First, it is vital to know the distance to and the response time from the closest emergency medical service. If you're working in confined spaces, do you know where the confined space rescue team is coming from? When we're working in remote locations and it's first responders and that tone goes out, how long before they get to the fire station before they're coming out? Next, every job should have more than one American Red Cross certified first responder. This is what I want you to do. I want you to plan a Saturday and take the entire crew. Take everybody. Everybody should be trained up and understand what we're getting into. You know, over the past 10 years of me working with the U.S. military on drilling projects and having those discussions, it's always been curious to me when I talk with who the medic or the triage professional is on site and what they have for a proper first aid kit for drilling sites. And you know what? Every conversation leads to the same conclusion. The drilling process presents just as many hazards as the front lines in a combat zone. I want you to think about that. Do we train the way we fight or do we fight the way we train? A first aid kit should include everything to combat burns, eye injuries, snake bites, and lacerations. The week after Labor Day, I heard about a young man who tore his arm open on a service job and started bleeding profusely. And this is what happened. By the time the first responders got there, he was nearly able to respond. He's stable now, but could we have done better? Could we have, including with those lacerations and snake bites, could we have had tourniquets and compresses for excessive bleeding? And could we have had featured detailed instructions for treating an unresponsive employee with multiple levels of trauma? We could have. OSHA requires many remote working construction trades, such as logging, electrical linemen, pipeline construction, and exploration mining, which is industrial drilling there, guys, to have more complex triage first aid kits and a staff that can stabilize an injured team member while help is more than 15 minutes away. Sure, we work in many areas where EMS is less than 10 minutes away. But for that first responder to be prepared to aid in the serious injuries, could we have helped? Could we have stabilized? Do we understand what's happening if somebody stops breathing or there's uncontrolled bleeding, there's cardiac arrest? In these situations, the first few minutes of aid can help prevent permanent medical impairment or death. Of course, a good safety program documenting near misses, the creation of good standard operating procedures and job safety analysis are one way to fight these catastrophic events. In our daily safety meeting, we should take time to check in with everybody and understand their mindset and all of the hazards we have for that day. It's big for us to consider. You know, we get that distracting text. Grandma goes in with chest pains and suddenly we're mentally there with grandma. We're physically on site. We're not mentally there anymore. We're thinking about what's happening with grandma. That's why the Stop Work Authority is one of the best tools we have in our first aid kit. Finally, training for a catastrophic event with a drill team is a perfect way to know if everyone is prepared, who's calling 911, who's getting the first aid kit. The worst situation is having the right tools on site to save a life, but the lack of team coordination to make a timely save. I want you to think about this. What is your plan? What does your first aid kit look like? Is it blue paper towel and electrical tape? Is it something that we picked up from Grainger that is really designed for an office? We need the right tools on site, no different than the bit and the drilling fluid or the right pump hoist. Be safe out there. Let's talk some oil and gas drilling for this week in the news. The Department of Interior last month announced a new proposed rule to ensure offshore oil and gas operations on the outer continental shelf are conducted with the utmost safety and oversight standards. This proposed rule from the Bureau of Safety and Environment Enforcement builds on the reforms instituted by the department since the Deepwater Horizon tragedy that killed 11 offshore workers, caused billions of dollars of damage, and made lasting impacts to the environmental landscape in the Gulf of Mexico. I was working in Houston, Texas when this happened, sitting in my office, and it's the same time that the Chilean miners got trapped. And I knew in days we'd have this well shut in, and we'd start the triage method, and I didn't think these miners would get out. And alternatively, the miners were rescued, and this thing went on for 87 days. The proposed revisions to the 2019 Well Control Rule, which will be in Federal Register by the beginning of September, focuses on well integrity and blowout prevention. Remember, the BOP failed on this, and we weren't able to shut it in with a myriad of other things that went wrong. These innovations will help protect human lives and environment by incorporating the latest technology and the lessons learned from operators' experience and incident data since the current rule was adopted in the immediate aftermath of the Deepwater Horizon incident in 2010. The Safety and Environment Group adopted several recommendations from multiple investigation teams to improve the safety of offshore energy operations, leading to the publication of a 2016 Well Control Rule. However, in May 2019, when it was published, the final rule, many of the provisions were weakened. So, last month's proposed rule would revise some of those items that were amended or rescinded in 2019. This is all to further protect human lives and the environment. The department is proposing revisions that would require blowout preventer systems to be able to close and seal the wellbore to the well's kick tolerance design at all times. It failed. It was stuck. We have a dozen different things that we've heard as an industry about this, but it failed. And it starts with removing the option for operators to submit failure data to designated third parties, and instead, they're required to submit that directly to the Department of the Interior's Safety and Environment team. It requires failure analysis and investigations to start within 90 days instead of 120. It's all about reaction time. It's all about us understanding that what we're doing is complex, high pressure, high temperature drilling fluids, lots of moving parts. Obviously, we need our last line of defense to perform. It also requires independent of third parties to be accredited by a qualified standard development organization, specifying that surface BOPs on existing floating facilities must follow the dual shear RAM requirements when replacing an entire BOP stack. It's also going to require that remote operated vehicles be capable of opening and closing each shear RAM on the BOP and require the operator to provide test results to the Department of Interior within 72 hours after completion of the test, if the safety team is unable to witness the testing in person. All of this publication of proposed rules also initiates a 60-day public comment period. Members of the public may submit comments on the proposed rulemaking until November 14th, 2022. Just like everything we talk about with the rules that are made from the EPA and the Department of Interior, they open it up for discussion and education. And this is why. The Deepwater Horizon oil spill was the largest spill in U.S. history. It dumped over 130 million gallons of oil into the Gulf of Mexico. In 87 days, it impacted five states and 1,300 miles of shoreline, with businesses and individuals impacted, along with all the shutdowns that happened. And this is before the ecosystem being considered and all the damage. Scientists concluded that the Deepwater Horizon oil spill killed thousands of marine mammals and sea turtles and contaminated their habitats. The restoration settlement for BP was $8.8 billion. But in reality, scientists are still uncovering impacts every day, and there's more and more cost. If we want to get back to efficient drilling in the Gulf, and we have to be able to drill, we have just a ton of availability there. We have to innovate. We have to look at what triage measures we have, having unmanned underwater vehicles being able to operate a BOP RAM after the platform has burned to the ground. It's a big deal. This is all the methods that we need so that we can continue our drilling industry. And this is a big thing to be talking about. And it's great work by the Department of Interior. For our main story of the week, yes, this is our 30th episode. We've spent a majority of our time talking about water regulation that isn't directly groundwater, but how it is 100% impacting groundwater and what's happening with the waters of the United States and the EPA. We need to continue to stay up to date and educated on. On September 14th, what the EPA did with the rivers in Massachusetts is a pretty big deal. And we right now are 1 week away from the starting of the case for the Supreme Court, Sackett versus the EPA. And we saw as the Supreme Court took break that we had the EPA versus West Virginia, where it was ruled in favor of West Virginia. It's a big situation. Sackett versus the EPA is a 14-year ongoing battle. And there's a lot happening here, and a lot of it has to do with protecting waters of the United States, navigable waters, understanding how things are interconnected. And I hope in the next few weeks to be able to get Jesse Richardson on with the Water System Council to talk more about this, who will be able to educate us on a whole nother level. The United States Environmental Protection Agency on September 14th announced decisive action to control currently unregulated stormwater pollution from entering unchecked into watersheds of the Charles, the Mystic, and the Neponset River, and control those pollutants under the Clean Water Act. This is the first time the EPA has exercised its residual designation authority under the Clean Water Act on such a broad scale to address watersheds in major urban areas. We've been talking a lot about underserved communities being impacted by runoff. Look what happens in St. Louis. We can see the same thing in the South. This is a big deal. The innovative effort is to expect to dramatically improve the water quality throughout the watershed, as well as reduce localized flooding and increase recreational opportunities through healthier river systems in historically disadvantaged neighborhoods. Under the September 14th action, the EPA is utilizing a Clean Water Act provision called Residual Designation Authority, under which the agency will require permit coverage for stormwater discharge from currently unregulated and uncontrolled sources of stormwater pollution in the Charles, the Mystic, and the Neponset River watersheds. Certain commercial, industrial, and institutional properties with one or more acres of impervious area, you know, our hard surfaces, parking lots, roofs, roadways, that make it difficult for stormwater to soak into the ground will be required to obtain coverage under the EPA Clean Water Act permit. So they will be able to permit, which is no different than what is happening with Sackett versus the EPA, is them going through the permitting process. However, that process can be years and from $50,000 to over $300,000 to get it done, and engineering and studies and everything that goes into it. So it's tough, and this is why this will be contested and will be an argument, and it's setting a precedent. Once permits are issued, property owners will be required to take steps to reduce pollutants in stormwater. The EPA anticipates issuing one or more general permits specifying the activities that property owners must implement to reduce stormwater pollution from their properties. Privately owned commercial, industrial, and institutional properties with 1 acre or greater of, again, impervious cover will need to seek coverage under one of these permits, or an individual permit if that's the direction they prefer. And then they have to take action spelled out in the permits to mitigate these pollutions from going into these rivers. This goes into Boston Harbor. Massachusetts has a fantastic groundwater protection and surface water protection programs. And for the EPA to step in, this is a big deal. The general permits will be released in draft form for the public comment in the future. Public comments on the determination will also be accepted at the time, consistent with EPA regulations. This is what we're looking at. The National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System. We need to know what's getting into our watersheds, that's ultimately going into our water supplies. We have to be able to control runoff. We see the extreme weather. We see the climate change. This is a big deal. The situation of enforcing residual designation authority just a few weeks before the Supreme Court hears the case of Sackett versus the EPA. We see what's happening here. Right now, you can find dozens of law, scholarly articles, and firms stating that the EPA's decision to act is just as a distraction or a further supplement for Sackett to the EPA. I see the same thing. However, we need to understand that petitions in 2019 and 2020 to stop these pollutants were established. There's three petitions that call for a determination that discharges of stormwater that are not currently subject to direct permitting by the EPA from privately owned commercials, industrial properties, institutionals, and multifamily residential real estate properties of 1 acre or greater that dump into the Charles River, the Mystic River, and the Neponset River watersheds are contaminating it, are impacting it. They're contributing to the violations of the water quality standards. The Charles River and the Boston Harbor, of which are the Mystic River watershed subbasin. And then we also have the Neponset River. They all require, under the National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System, Waters of the United States, the Clean Water Act, require the right permits and the regulations. You can find these petitions at epa.gov. Sackett versus the EPA. This is the argument that starts on October 3rd, 1 week from today. This is the argument. Petitioners Michael and Chantel Sackett own a vacant lot in a mostly built-out residential subdivision near Priest Lake, Idaho. The lot has no surface water connection to any body of water. In April 2007, with local permits in hand, the Sacketts began building a family home. But later that year, respondent Environmental Protection Agency sent them an administrative compliance order determining that their home construction violated the Clean Water Act because their lot contains wetlands that qualify as regulated navigable waters. In Rapanzos versus United States, 2006, the court held that Clean Water Act does not regulate all wetlands, but no opinion explaining why was ever garnered a majority of the court. A polarity opinion authored by Justice Scalia and joined by three other justices argued that only those wetlands that have a continuous surface water connection to regulated waters may themselves be regulated. Get that surface water moving to Priest Lake. However, a concurring opinion by Justice Kennedy advanced a different and much broader test, allowing for regulation of wetlands regardless of any surface connection, so long as the wetlands bear an significant nexus with traditional navigable waters. The Ninth Circuit employed Justice Kennedy's significant nexus test to uphold the EPA's authority over the Sackett's home site. So on October 3rd, the question presented is, should Rapanzos be revisited to adopt the polarity test for wetlands jurisdiction under the Clean Water Act? Go listen to the Waters of the United States roundtables and the discussion about ephemeral streams and surface water on farmland and what's happening right here. We need to understand, from the use of residual designation authority, if the EPA can prove that those wetlands connect to Priest Lake and what's going to happen. This is a big deal, and it's going to affect major industry and farming and discharge permits. And we have to protect our water without a doubt, and we have to protect our wetlands. We have excessive rain. We have extreme weather. October 3rd, this starts. We're going to see it in all the major news publications and on NPR. And we need to be paying attention to it and understanding how it could impact us and how it can impact watersheds and the groundwater. Thank you for joining us for episode 30 of the Driller Newscast. We've covered a lot of industry news and stories in the past 30 weeks, from hiring the next generation, where we talked with Dave Bowers, Jake Fletcher, Jim Smith, to clean energy, where we had on Jay Egg and Garen Eubank, and just recently Donovan Gordon with NYSERDA. Go check those episodes out. And then on to how the world is impacted by extreme weather and water shortages. Type into your search engine drought measurements or restrictions, and it's just not the Western United States cities that are conserving water. There's cities in Texas, there's cities in Kansas, there's cities in New York, there's cities in Virginia, in Maine, in Massachusetts. There are many water systems right now that are 6 to 8 weeks of conservation measures so that they can continue to run. I want to thank Wild Bend Incorporated for helping the Driller bring the news that is helping our industry to advocate for what is most important to us: water, the climate, clean energy, progressing our industry, maintaining our livelihood. Wyobin Inc., a privately held family-owned business, has been providing high-quality drilling fluid products since 1951. Wyobin's knowledgeable customer service, sales, and research people bring industry-leading products and support to the marketplace. The innovative products are the results of field-driven solutions and dedication to the customer's goals. Thank you, Wyobin. It's been great having you be our partner for the month of September. Check out their innovative products, from grouts to specialty polymers for all sorts of industries to high-quality bentonites that excel in your expectations of being able to perform. And I'm not just saying that. I've been on jobs and been very successful running their products, and I appreciate the quality and dedication they put into it. Have a great week. Be safe. Check out thedriller.com and be paying attention to the news. Thank you.